Tithing's in the Bible. You're supposed to give 10% of everything, and storking's in the Bible, too.
No, it isn't.
Moses, says Lev. Moses was put in a basket in the Nile and was found by Pharaoh's daughter. He was the first storked baby. And look what happened to him.
Yeah, says Connor. What happened to the next baby she found in the Nile?
Will you keep your voices down? Says Risa. People could hear you in the hall. Anyway, you might wake Dee Dee.
Connor takes a moment to collect his thoughts. When he speaks again, it's a whisper. But in a tiled room, there are no whispers.
We got storked when I was 7.
Big deal, says Risa.
No, this was a big deal. For a whole lot of reasons. See, there were already 2 natural kids in the family. My parents weren't planning on any more. Anyway, this baby shows up at our door. My parents start freaking out. And then they have an idea.
Do I want to hear this? Risa asks.
Probably not.
But Connor's not about to stop. He knows if he doesn't spill this now, he's never going to.
It was early in the morning, and my parents figured no one saw the baby left at the door, right? So the next morning, before the rest of us got up, my dad put the baby on a doorstep across the street.
That's illegal, announces Lev. Once you get storked, that baby is yours.
Yeah, but my parents figured, who's gonna know? My parents swore us to secrecy, and we waited to hear the news from across the street about their new, unexpected arrival. But it never came. They never talked about getting storked, and we couldn't ask them about it, because it would be a dead giveaway that we'd dump the baby on them. As Connor speaks, the stall, as small as it is, seems to shrink around him. He knows the others are there on either side, but he can't help but feel desperately alone. Things go on like it never happened. Everything was quiet for a while, and then, 2 weeks later, I open the door, and there on that stupid welcome mat is another baby in a basket. And I remember I almost laughed. Can you believe it? I thought it was funny. And I turn back to my mother and I say, Mom, we got storked again. Just like that little kid this morning said. My mom, all frustrated, brought the baby in. And that's when she realizes,
oh no, says Risa, figuring it out even before Connor says,
it's the same baby.
Connor tries to remember the baby's face, but he can't. All he sees in his mind's eye is the face of the baby Risa now holds. Turns out that the baby had been passed around the neighborhood for 2 whole weeks, each morning left on someone else's doorstep. Only now it's not looking too good.
The bathroom door squeals, and Connor falls silent. A flurry of footsteps. 2 girls. They chat a bit about boys and dates and parties with no parents around. They don't even use the toilets. Another flurry of footsteps heading out, the squeal of the door, and they are alone again.
So what happened to the baby? Risa asks.
By the time it landed on our doorstep again, it was sick. It was coughing like a seal, and its skin and eyes were yellow.
Jaundice, says Risa gently. A lot of babies show up at the stay-ho that way.
My parents brought it to the hospital, but there was nothing they could do. I was there when it died. I saw it die.
Connor closes his eyes and grits his teeth to keep the tears back. He knows the others can't see them, but he doesn't want them to come anyway.
I remember thinking, if a baby was going to be so unloved, why would God want it brought into the world?
He wonders if Lev will have some pronouncement on the topic. After all, when it comes to God, Lev claimed to have all the answers. But all Lev says is,
I didn't know you believed in God.
Connor takes a moment to push his emotions down, then continues.
Anyway, since it was legally ours, we paid for the funeral. It didn't even have a name. My parents couldn't bear to give it one. It was just Baby Lassiter. And even though no one had wanted it, the entire neighborhood came to the funeral. People were crying like it was their baby that had died. And that's when I realized that the people who were crying, they were the ones who had passed that baby around. They were the ones, just like my own parents, who had a hand in killing it.
There's silence now. The leaky flush handle drizzles. Next door in the boys' bathroom, a toilet flushes, and the sound echoes hollowly around them.
People shouldn't give away babies that get left at their door,
Lev finally says.
People shouldn't stork their babies,
Risa responds.
People shouldn't do a lot of things, says Connor.
He knows they're both right, but it doesn't make a difference. In a perfect world, mothers would all want their babies, and strangers would open up their homes to the unloved. In a perfect world, everything would be either black or white, right or wrong, and everyone would know the difference. But this isn't a perfect world. The problem is people who think it is.
Anyway, I just wanted you to know.
In a few moments, the bell rings, and there's commotion in the hall. The bathroom door creaks open. Girls laughing, talking about everything and nothing.
Next time wear a dress. Can I borrow your history book? That test was impossible.
Unending squeals from the door and constant tugs on Connor's locked stall door. No one's tall enough to look over. No one has any desire to look under. The late bell rings. The last girl hurries to class. They've made it to second period. If they're lucky, this school will have a mid-morning break. Maybe they can sneak out then. In Reese's stall, the baby is making wakeful noises. Not crying, but sort of clicking, on the verge of hungry tears.
Should we change stalls?
Asks Risa.
Repeat visitors might get suspicious if they see my feet in the same stall.
Good idea. Listening closely to make sure he can't hear any footfalls in the hall, Connor pulls open his stall, switching places with Risa. Lev's door is open as well, but he's not coming out. Connor pushes Lev's door open all the way. He's not there.
Lev?
He looks to Risa, who just shakes her head. They check every stall, then check the one Lev was in again, as if he might reappear. But he doesn't. Lev is gone. And the baby begins wailing for all it's worth.
15. Lev. Lev is convinced his heart will explode in his chest. It will explode, and he will die right here in a school hallway. Slipping out of the bathroom once the bell rang had been nerve-wracking. He had unlocked his stall door and had kept his hand on the handle for 10 minutes waiting for the electronic buzz of the bell to mask the sound of its opening. Then he'd had to make it to the bathroom entrance without the others hearing his brand new sneakers squeaking on the floor. Why did they call them sneakers if it was so hard to sneak in them? He couldn't open that squealing door, then walk out by himself. It would be too conspicuous. So he waited until a bathroom-bound girl did it for him. Since the bell had just rung, he only had to wait a few seconds. She pulled open the door and he pushed his way past her, hoping she didn't say anything that would give him away. If she commented about a boy being in the girl's bathroom, Connor and Risa would know.
Next time wear a dress,
the girl said to him as he hurried away, and her friend laughed. Was that enough to alert Connor and Risa to his escape? He hadn't turned back to find out. He had just pressed forward. Now he's lost in the hallways of the huge high school, his heart threatening to detonate at any second. A wild mob of kids hurrying to their next class surround him, bump him, disorient him. Most of the kids here are bigger than Lev, imposing. Intimidating. This is how he always imagined high school, a dangerous place full of mystery and violent kids. He had never worried about it because he had always known he would never have to go. In fact, he only had to worry about getting partway through eighth grade.
Excuse me, can you tell me where the office is?
He asks one of the slower moving students. The kid looks down at him as if Lev were from Mars.
How could you not know that?
And he just walks away, shaking his head. Another, kinder kid points him in the right direction. Lev knows that things must be put back on track. This is the best place to do it, a school. If there are any secret plans to kill Connor and Risa, it can't happen here with so many kids around. And if he does this right, it won't happen at all. If he does it right, all three of them will be safely on their way to their unwinding, as it ought to be. as it was ordained to be. The thought of it still frightens him, but these days of not knowing what the next hour will bring, that is truly terrifying. Being torn from his purpose was the most unnerving thing that had ever happened to Lev. But now he understands why God let it happen. It's a lesson. It's to show Lev what happens to children who shirk their destiny. They become lost in every possible way. He enters the school's main office and stands at the counter, waiting to be noticed, but the secretary is too busy shuffling papers.
"Excuse me?"
Finally, she looks up.
"Can I help you, dear?"
He clears his throat.
"My name is Levi Calder, and I've been kidnapped by two runaway unwinds."
The woman, who really wasn't paying attention before, suddenly focuses her attention entirely on him.
"What did you say?" "I was kidnapped. We were hiding in a bathroom, but I got away. They're still there. They've got a baby, too."
The woman stands up and calls out, her voice shaky, like she's looking at a ghost. She calls in the principal, and the principal calls in a security guard. A minute later, Lev sits in the nurse's office, with the nurse doting on him like he's got a fever.
"Don't you worry," she says. "Whatever happened to you, it's all over now."
From here in the nurse's office, Lev has no way of knowing if they've captured Connor and Risa. He hopes that, if they have, they don't bring them here. The thought of having to face them makes him feel ashamed. Doing the right thing shouldn't make you feel ashamed.
"The police have been called. Everything's being taken care of," the nurse tells him. "You'll be going home soon."
"I'm not going home," he tells her. The nurse looks at him strangely, and he decides not to go into it.
"Never mind. Can I call my parents?"
She looks at him, incredulous.
"You mean no one's done that for you?"
She looks at the school phone in the corner, then fumbles for her cell phone in her pocket instead.
"You call and let them know you're okay, and talk as long as you like."
She looks at him for a moment, then decides to give him his privacy, stepping out of the room.
"I'll be right here if you need me."
Lev begins to dial, but stops himself. It's not his parents he wants to talk to. He erases the numbers and keys in a different one, hesitates for a moment, then hits the send button. It's picked up on the second ring.
"Hello? Pastor Dan?"
There's only a split second of dead air, and then recognition.
"Dear God, Lev? Lev, is that you? Where are you?"
"I don't know. Some school?
Listen, you have to tell my parents to stop the police. I don't want them killed."
"Lev, slow down. Are you all right?"
"They kidnapped me, but they didn't hurt me, so I don't want them hurt. Tell my father to call off the police."
"I don't know what you're talking about. We never told the police."
Lev is not expecting to hear this.
"You never what?"
"Your parents were going to. They were going to make a whole big deal about it, but I convinced them not to. I convinced them that your being kidnapped was somehow God's will."
Lev starts shaking his head like he can shake the thought away.
But why would you do that?"
Now Pastor Dan starts to sound desperate.
"Lev, listen to me. Listen to me carefully. No one else knows that you're gone. As far as anyone knows, you've been tithed, and people don't ask questions about children who are tithed. Do you understand what I'm telling you?"
"But I want to be tithed. I need to be. You have to call my parents and tell them. You have to get me to harvest camp."
Now Pastor Dan gets angry.
"Don't make me do that. Please, don't make me do that."
It's as if he's fighting a battle, but somehow it's not Lev he's battling. This is so far from Lev's image of Pastor Dan, he can't believe it's the same person he's known all these years. It's like an imposter has stolen the pastor's voice, but none of his convictions.
"Don't you see, Lev? You can save yourself. You can be anyone you want to be now."
And all at once the truth comes to Lev. Pastor Dan wasn't telling him to run away from the kidnapper that day. He was telling Lev to run away from him, from his parents, from his tithing. After all his sermons and lectures, after all that talk year after year about Lev's holy duty, it's all been a sham. Lev was born to be tithed. and the man who convinced him this was a glorious and honorable fate doesn't believe it.
Lev? Lev, are you there?
He's there, but he doesn't want to be. He doesn't want to answer this man who led him to a cliff, only to turn away at the last minute. Now Lev's emotions spin like a wheel of fortune. One moment he's furious, the next, relieved. One instant he's filled with terror so extreme he can smell it like acid in his nostrils, and the next, there's a spike of joy, like what he used to feel when he swung away and heard the crack of his bat against a ball. He is that ball now, soaring away. His life has been like a ballpark, hasn't it? All lines, structure, and rules never changing. But now he's been hit over the wall into unknown territory.
Lev, says Pastor Dan, you're scaring me. Talk to me.
Lev takes a slow, deep breath, then says,
goodbye, sir.
Then he hangs up without another word. Lev sees police cars arrive outside. Connor and Risa will soon be caught, if they haven't been caught already. The nurse is no longer standing at the door. She's chiding the principal for how he's handling the situation.
Why didn't you call the poor boy's parents? Why haven't you put the school in lockdown?
Lev knows what he has to do. It's something wrong. It's something bad. But suddenly, he doesn't care. He slips out of the office right behind the nurses and the principal's backs and goes out into the hallway. It only takes a second to find what he's looking for. He reaches for the little box on the wall.
I am lost in every possible way.
Then, feeling the coldness of the steel against his fingertips, he pulls the fire alarm. 16. Teacher. The fire alarm goes off during the teacher's prep period, and she silently curses the powers that be for their awful timing. Perhaps, she thinks, if she can just stay in her empty classroom until the false alarm, and it's always a false alarm, is dealt with. But then, what kind of example would she be setting if students passing by looked in to see her sitting there? As she leaves the room, the hallways are already filling with students. Teachers try their best to keep them organized, but this is a high school. The organized lines of elementary school fire drills are long gone, having been replaced by the brazen hormonal zigzags of kids whose bodies are too big for their own good. Then she sees something strange, something troubling. There are two policemen by the front office. They actually seem intimidated by the mob of kids flowing past them and out the front doors of the school. But why policemen? Why not firemen? And how could they have gotten here so quickly? They couldn't have. They must have been called before the alarm went off. But why? The last time there were policemen in the school, someone called in a clapper threat. The school was evacuated, and no one knew why until after the fact. Turns out, there was no clapper. The school was never in danger of being blown up. It was just some kid pulling a practical joke. Still, clapper threats are always taken seriously, because you never know when the threat might be real.
Please, no pushing! She says to a student who bumps her elbow. I'm sure we'll all make it outside.
Good thing she didn't take her coffee.
Sorry, Miss Steinberg.
As she passes one of the science labs, she notices the door ajar. Just to be thorough, she peeks in to make sure there are no stragglers, or kids trying to avoid the mass exodus. The stone-top tables are bare and the chairs are all in place. No one had been in the lab this period. She reaches to pull the door closed, more out of habit than anything else, when she hears a sound that is wholly out of place in the room. A baby's cry. At first she thinks it might be coming from the student mother nursery, but the nursery is way down the hall. This cry definitely came from the lab. She hears the cry again, only this time it sounds oddly muffled and angrier. She knows that sound. Someone's trying to cover the baby's mouth to keep it from crying. These teen mothers always do that when they have their babies where they don't belong. They never seem to realize it only makes the baby cry louder.
Party's over, she calls out. Come on, you and your baby have to leave with everyone else.
But they don't come out. There's that muffled cry again, followed by some intense whispering that she can't quite make out. Annoyed, she steps into the lab and storms down the center aisle looking left and right, until she finds them crouched behind one of the lab tables. It's not just a girl and a baby, there's a boy there, too. There's a look of desperation about them. The boy looks as if he might bolt, but the girl grabs him firmly with her free hand. It keeps him in place. The baby wails. The teacher might not know every name in school, but she's fairly certain she knows every face. And she certainly knows all the student mothers. This isn't one of them, and the boy's completely unfamiliar, too. The girl looks at her, eyes pleading. Too frightened to speak, she just shakes her head. It's the boy who speaks.
If you turn us in, we'll die.
At the thought, the girl holds the baby closer to her. Its cries lessen but don't go away entirely. Clearly, these are the ones the police are looking for reasons she can only guess at.
Please, says the boy. Please what?
The teacher thinks.
Please break the law? Please put myself and the school at risk?
But no, that's not it at all. What he's really saying is, please be a human being. With a life so full of rules and regiments, it's so easy to forget that's what they are. She knows, she sees, how often compassion takes a back seat to expediency. Then a voice from behind her. Anna? She turns to see another teacher looking in from the door. He's a bit disheveled, having fought the raging rapids of kids still funneling out of the school. He obviously hears the baby's cries. How could he not? Is everything all right? He asks.
Yeah,
says Hannah, with more calm in her voice than she actually feels.
I'm taking care of it.
The other teacher nods and leaves, probably glad not to share the burden of whatever this crying baby situation is. Hannah now knows what the situation is, however, or at least she suspects. Kids only have this kind of desperation in their eyes when they're going to be unwound. She holds out her hand to the frightened kids.
Come with me.
The kids are hesitant, so she says,
If they're looking for you, they'll find you once the building is empty. You can't expect to hide here. If you want to get out, you have to leave with everyone else. Come on, I'll help you.
Finally, they rise from behind the lab table, and she breathes a sigh of relief. She can tell they still don't trust her, but then, why should they? Unwinds exist in the constant shadow of betrayal. Well, they don't need to trust her now, they just need to go with her. In this case, necessity is the mother of compliance, and that's just fine.
Don't tell me your names, she says to them. Don't tell me anything, so if they question me afterward, I won't be lying when I say I don't know.
There are still crowds of kids pushing past in the hall, heading toward the nearest exit. She steps out of the room, making sure the two kids and their baby are right behind her. She will help them. Whoever they are, she will do her best to get them to safety. What kind of example would she be setting if she didn't? 17. Risa. Police down the hall. Police at the exits. Risa knows this is Lev's doing. He didn't just run away. He turned them in. This teacher says she's helping them, but what if she's not? What if she's just leading them to the police?
Don't think about that now. Keep your eyes on the baby.
Policemen know panic when they see it. But if her eyes are turned to the baby, her panic might be read as concern for the baby's tears.
If I ever see Lev again, says Connor, I'll tear him to pieces.
Shh, says the teacher, leading them along with the crowd to the exit. Risa can't blame Connor for his anger. She blames herself for not seeing through Lev's sham. How could she have been so naive to think he was truly on their side?
We should have let the little creep be unwound, grumbles Connor.
Shut up, says Risa. Let's just get out of this.
As they near the door, another policeman comes into view standing just outside.
Give me the baby,
the teacher orders, and Risa does as she's told. She doesn't yet realize why the woman asked for the baby, but it doesn't matter. It's wonderful to have someone leading the way who seems to know what they're doing. Perhaps this woman isn't the enemy after all. Perhaps she truly will get them through this.
Let me go ahead, the teacher says. The two of you separate and just walk out with the rest of the kids.
Without the baby to look at, Risa knows she can't hide the panic in her eyes. But suddenly she realizes that it might not matter. And now she understands why the woman took the baby. Yes, Lev turned them in. But if they're lucky, these local police may only have a description of them to go by. A scruffy-haired boy and a dark-haired girl with a baby. Take away the baby, and that could be half the kids in this school. The teacher, Hannah, passes the policeman a few yards ahead of them, and he gives her only a momentary glance. But then he looks toward Risa, and his eyes lock on her. Risa knows she's just given herself away. Should she turn and race back into the school? Where's Connor now? Is he behind her or in front of her? She has no idea. She's completely alone. And then salvation arrives in a most unlikely form.
Hi, Dee Dee.
It's Alexis, the talkative girl from the school bus. She comes up beside her with Chase gnawing at her shoulder.
People pull the alarms all the time, she says. Well, at least I got out of math.
Suddenly the policeman's eyes shift to Alexis.
Stop right there, miss.
Alexis looks stunned.
Who, me?
Step aside. We'd like to ask you a few questions.
Risa walks right on past, holding her breath for fear that her gasp of relief might draw the officer's attention again. Risa no longer fits the profile of what they're looking for, but Alexis does. Risa doesn't look back. She just continues down the steps to the street. In a few moments, Connor catches up with her.
I saw what happened back there. Your friend may have just saved your life.
I'll have to thank her later.
Up ahead, Hannah reaches into her pocket with her free hand, pulls out her car keys, then turns left toward the faculty parking lot.
It's all going to be okay, Risa thinks. She's going to get us out of here.
Risa might just start believing in miracles and angels. And then she hears a familiar voice behind her.
Wait! Stop!
She turns to see Lev. He spotted them. And although he's far away, he's quickly working his way through the crowd toward them.
Risa! Connor! Wait!
It wasn't enough to just turn them in. Now he's leading the cops directly to them. And he's not the only one. Alexis still stands with the policeman at the school's side entrance. From where she stands, she can easily see Risa, and she points Risa out to the cop. The cop instantly pulls out his radio to inform the other officers.
Connor, we're in trouble.
I know. I see it too.
Wait!
Screams Lev, still far away, but getting closer. Risa looks for Hannah, but she's vanished into the crowd of kids in the parking lot. Connor looks at Risa, fear overwhelming the fury in his eyes.
Run.
This time Risa doesn't hesitate. She runs with him, breaking toward the street just as a fire truck bursts onto the scene, siren blaring. The truck stops right in their path. There's nowhere to run. The fire alarm had mercifully been pulled at the perfect time, and it's gotten them this far, but the commotion is fading. Kids are milling instead of moving, and cops in every direction zero in on the two of them. What they need is a fresh commotion, something even worse than a fire alarm. The answer comes even before Risa can formulate the entire idea in her mind. She speaks without even knowing what she's about to say.
Start clapping.
What?
Start clapping. Trust me.
A single nod from Connor makes it clear that he gets it, and he begins bringing his hands together, slowly at first, then more and more quickly. She does the same, both of them applauding as if they were at a concert cheering for their favorite band. And beside them, a student drops his backpack and stares at them in utter horror.
Clappers!
He screams. In an instant, the word is out. Clappers, clappers, clappers. It echoes in the kids around them. In an instant, it reaches critical mass, and the entire crowd is in full-blown panic.
Clappers!
Everyone screams. And the crowd becomes a stampede. Kids bolt, but no one is sure where to go. All they know is that they must get away from the school as quickly as possible. Risa and Connor continue to clap, their hands red from the force of their duet of applause. With the mob racing in blind terror, the cops can't get to them. Lev has vanished, trampled by the panicked mob, and everything is made worse by the fire siren, which blares like it's sounding out the end of the world. They stop clapping and join the stampede, becoming a part of the running crowd. That's when someone comes up beside them. It's Hannah. Her plans of driving them off campus are gone, so she quickly hands Risa the baby.
There's an antique shop on Fleming Street, she tells them. Ask for Sonia. She can help you.
We're not clappers,
is all Risa can think to say.
I know you're not. Good luck.
There's no time to thank her. In a moment, the wild crowd pulls them apart, taking Hannah in a different direction. Risa stumbles and realizes they're in the middle of the street. Traffic has come to a halt as hundreds of kids race in a mad frenzy to escape the terrorists, wherever they are. The baby in Risa's arms bawls, but its cries are nothing compared to the screams of the mob. In a moment, they are across the street and gone with the crowd. 18. Lev. This is the true meaning of alone. Lev Calder, beneath the trampling feet of a stampeding crowd.
Risa! Connor, help!
He should never have called out their names, but it's too late to change that now. They ran from him when he called. They didn't wait. They ran. They hate him. They know what he did. Now hundreds of feet race over Lev like he's not there. His hand is stomped on. A boot comes down on his chest, and a kid springboards off of him to get greater speed.
Clappers.
They're all screaming about clappers, just because he pulled the stupid alarm. He has to catch up with Risa and Connor. He has to explain, to tell them that he's sorry, that he was wrong to turn them in and that he pulled the alarm to help them escape. He has to make them understand. They are his only friends now. They were, but not anymore. He's ruined everything. Finally, the stampede thins out enough for Lev to pick himself up. A knee of his jeans is torn. He tastes blood. He must have bitten his tongue. He tries to assess the situation. Most of the mob is off campus, in the street and beyond, disappearing down side streets. Only stragglers are left.
Don't just stand there, says a kid hurrying past. There are clappers on the roof.
No, says another kid. I heard they're in the cafeteria.
All around Lev, the bewildered cops pace with a false determination in their stride, as if they know exactly where to go, only to turn around and pace with the same determination in another direction. Connor and Risa have left him. He realizes that if he doesn't leave now with the last of the stragglers, he'll draw the attention of the police. He runs away, feeling more helpless than a storked baby. He doesn't know who to blame for this. Pastor Dan for cutting him loose? Himself for betraying the only two kids willing to help him? Or should he blame God for allowing his life to reach this bitter moment?
You can be anyone you want to be now, Pastor Dan had said. But right now, Lev feels like no one.
This is the true meaning of alone. Levi Jedediah Calder, suddenly realizing he no longer exists. 19. Connor. The antique shop is in an older part of town. Trees arch over the street, their branches cut into unnatural angular patterns by the profiles of passing trucks. The street is full of yellow and brown leaves, but enough diehards still cling to the branches to make a shady canopy. The baby is inconsolable, and Connor wants to complain to Risa about it, but knows that he can't. If it hadn't been for him, the baby wouldn't even be part of the equation. There aren't all that many people on the street, but there are enough. Mostly it's kids from the high school just knocking around, probably spreading more rumors about clappers, trying to detonate themselves.
I hear they're anarchists. I hear it's some weird religion. I hear they just do it to do it.
The threat of clappers is so effective because no one knows what they really stand for.
That was smart back there, Connor tells Risa as they approach the antique shop. Pretending to be clappers, I mean? I would never have thought of that. He thought quickly enough to take out that juvie cop the other day with his own trank gun.
Connor grins. I go by instinct, you go by brains. I guess we make a pretty decent team.
Yeah, and we're a bit less dysfunctional without Lev.
At the mention of Lev, Connor feels a spike of anger. He rubs his sore arm where Lev bit him, but what Lev did today was much more painful than that. Forget about him. He's history. We got away, so his squealing on us doesn't matter. Now he'll get unwound just like he wants, and we won't have to deal with him again.
and yet the thought of it brings Connor a pang of regret. He had risked his life for Lev. He had tried to save him, but had failed. Maybe if Connor were better with words, he could have said something that would have truly won him over. But who was he kidding? Lev was a tithe from the moment he was born. You don't undo 13 years of brainwashing in 2 days. The antique shop is old. White paint peels from the front door. Connor pushes open the door and bells hanging high on the door jingle. Low-tech intruder alert. There's one customer, a sour-faced man in a tweed coat. He looks up at them, disinterested and maybe disgusted by the baby, because he wanders deeper into the recesses of the cluttered store to get away. The shop has things from perhaps every point in American history. A display of iPods and other little gadgets from his grandfather's time cover an old chrome-rimmed dinner table. An old movie plays on an antique plasma screen TV. The movie shows a crazy vision of a future that never came, with flying cars and a white-haired scientist.
Can I help you?
An old woman is hunched as a question mark comes out from behind the cash register. She walks with a cane, but she seems pretty sure-footed in spite of it. Risa bounces the baby to get its volume down.
We're looking for Sonia.
You found her. What do you want?
We need some help, Risa says.
Yeah, Connor chimes in. Someone told us to come here. The old woman looks at them suspiciously.
Does this have something to do with that fiasco over at the high school? Are you clappers?
Do we look like clappers to you? Says Connor. The woman narrows her eyes at him.
Nobody looks like a clapper.
Connor narrows his gaze to match hers, then goes over to the wall. He holds up his hand and jabs it forward with all his might, punching the wall hard enough to bruise his knuckles. A little painting of a fruit bowl falls off the wall. Connor catches it before it hits the ground and sets it on the counter. See? He says. My blood isn't explosive. If I were a clapper, this whole shop would be gone. The old woman stares at him, and it's a hard gaze for Connor to hold. There's some sort of fire in those weary eyes, but Connor doesn't look away.
See this hunch? She asks them. I got it from sticking my neck out for people like you.
Connor still won't break his gaze. Guess we came to the wrong place then. Glancing at Risa, he says, let's get out of here. He turns to leave and the old woman swings her cane sharply and painfully across his shins.
Not so fast. It just so happens that Hannah called me, so I knew you were coming.
Risa, still bouncing the baby, lets out a frustrated breath.
You could have told us when we came in.
What fun would that be?
By now, the sour-faced customer has made his way closer again, picking up item after item, his expression showing instant disapproval of everything in the shop.
I have some lovely infant items in the back room,
she tells them loud enough for the customer to hear.
Why don't you go back there and wait for me?
Then she whispers,
and for God's sake, feed that baby.
The back room is through a doorway covered by what looks like an old shower curtain. If the front room was cluttered, this place is a disaster area. Things like broken picture frames and rusty bird cages are piled all around. All the items that weren't good enough to be displayed out front. The junk of the junk.
And you're telling me this old woman is going to help us? Says Connor. Looks like she can't even help herself. Hannah said she would. I believe her.
How could you be raised in a state home and still trust people? Risa gives him a dirty look and says,
hold this.
She puts the baby in Connor's arms. It's the first time she's given it to him. It feels much lighter than he expected. Something so loud and demanding ought to be heavier. The baby's cries have weakened now. It's just about exhausted itself. There's nothing keeping them tied to this baby anymore. They could stork it again first thing in the morning. And yet the thought makes Connor uncomfortable. They don't owe this baby anything. It's theirs by stupidity, not biology. He doesn't want it, but he can't stand the thought of someone getting the baby who wants it even less than he does. His frustration begins to ferment into anger. It's the same kind of anger that always got him into trouble back home. It would cloud his judgment, making him lash out, getting into fights, cursing out teachers, or riding his skateboard wildly through busy intersections.
"Why do you have to get wound so tight?" his father once asked, exasperated. And Connor had snapped back. "Maybe someone ought to unwind me."
At the time, he thought he was just being funny. Risa opens a refrigerator, which is as cluttered as the rest of the back room. She pulls out a container of milk, then finds a bowl into which she pours the milk.
"It's not a cat," Connor says. "It won't lick milk out of a bowl."
"I know what I'm doing."
Connor watches as she rummages around in drawers until finding a clean spoon. Then she takes the baby from him. Sitting down, she cradles the baby a bit more skillfully than Connor. Then she dips the spoon into the milk and spills the spoonful into the baby's mouth. The baby begins to gag on the milk, coughing and sputtering. But then Risa puts her index finger into its mouth. It sucks on her finger and closes its eyes, satisfied. In a few moments, she crooks her finger enough to leave a little space for her to spill in another spoonful of milk, then lets the baby suck on her finger again.
"Wow, that's impressive," says Connor.
"Sometimes I got to take care of babies at Steho. You learn a few tricks. Let's just hope it's not lactose intolerant."
With the baby quieted, it's as if all the day's tension has been suddenly released. Connor's eyelids grow heavy, but he won't allow himself to fall asleep. They're not safe yet. They may never be, and he can't let his guard down now. Still, his mind begins to drift off. He wonders if his parents are still looking for him, or if it's just the police now. He thinks about Ariana. What would have happened to them if she had come along with him, as she had promised? They would have been caught on that first night. That's what would have happened. Ariana wasn't street smart like Risa. She wasn't resourceful. Thoughts of Ariana bring a wave of sadness and longing, but it's not as powerful a feeling as Connor thought it would be. How soon until she forgets him? How soon until everyone forgets him? Not long. That's what happens with unwinds. Connor had known other kids at school who disappeared over the past couple of years. One day they just didn't turn up. Teachers would say that they were gone or no longer enrolled. Those were just code words, though. Everyone knew what they meant. The kids who knew them would talk about how terrible it was and gripe about it for a day or two. And then it became old news. Unwinds didn't go out with a bang. They didn't even go out with a whimper. They went out with the silence of a candle flame pinched between two fingers. The customer finally leaves, and Sonia joins him in the back room.
"So, you're unwinds and you want my help, is that it?"
"Maybe just some food," says Connor. "Place to rest for a few hours, then we'll be on our way."
"We don't want to be any trouble," says Risa.
The old woman laughs at that.
"Yes, you do. You want to be trouble to everyone you meet."
She points her cane at Risa.
"That's what you are now. Trouble in caps lock."
Then she puts her cane down and softens a bit.
"That's not your fault, though. You didn't ask to be born, and you didn't ask to be unwound, either."
She looks back and forth between the two of them, then says to Risa, just as bald-faced as can be,
"If you really want to stay alive, honey, have him get you pregnant again. They won't unwind an expectant mother, so that will buy you 9 whole months.
Risa drops her jaw, speechless, and Connor feels a flush come to his face.
She wasn't pregnant the first time. It's not her baby, or mine.
Sonia considers this and takes a closer look at the baby.
"Not yours, Well, that explains why you're not breastfeeding."
She laughs suddenly and sharply. It makes Connor and the baby jump. Risa isn't startled, just annoyed. She gets the baby's attention again with another spoonful of milk and her index finger.
"Are you going to help us or not?"
Sonia lifts her cane and wraps it against Connor's arm, then points to a huge trunk covered with travel stickers.
"Think you're buff enough to bring that over here?"
Connor gets up, wondering what could possibly be of use to them in the trunk. He grabs onto it and struggles to push it across the faded Persian rug.
Not much of a buff, are you?
I never said I was. He inches the trunk across the floor until it's right in front of her. Instead of opening it, she sits on top of it and begins to massage her ankles.
So what's in it? Connor asks. Correspondence, she says. But it's not what's in it that matters, it's what's underneath.
Then, with her cane, she pushes away the rug where the trunk had been to reveal a trap door with a brass pull ring.
Go on, says Sonia, pointing again with her cane.
Connor sighs and grabs the ring, pulling open the trap door to reveal steep stone steps leading down into darkness. Risa puts down her bowl and, holding the baby over her shoulder in burping position, approaches the trap door, kneeling beside Connor.
This is an old building, Sonia tells them. Way back in the early 20th century, during the first prohibition, they hid hooch down there.
Hooch? Asks Connor.
Alcohol. I swear this whole generation's the same. Caps lock ignorant.
The steps down are steep and uneven. At first, Connor thinks Sonia will send them down alone, but she insists on leading the way. She takes her time and seems more sure-footed on the steps than she does on level ground. Connor tries to hold her arm to give her support, but she shakes him off and throws him a nasty gaze.
If I want your help, I'll ask. Do I look feeble to you?
Actually, yes.
Looks are deceiving, she says. After all, when I saw you, I thought you looked reasonably intelligent.
Very funny. At the bottom, Sonia reaches toward the wall and throws a light switch. Risa gasps, and Connor follows her gaze until he sees them. Three figures, a girl and two boys.
Your little family has just grown, Sonia tells them.
The kids don't move. They appear to be close to Connor's and Risa's age. Fellow unwinds, for sure. They look weary and exhausted. Connor wonders if he looks as bad.
For God's sake, stop staring, she says to them. You look like a pack of rats.
Sonia shuffles around the dusty cellar, pointing things out to Risa and Connor.
There are canned goods on these shelves and a can opener around somewhere. Eat whatever you want, but don't leave anything over. You really will see rats. Bathroom's back there. Keep it clean. I'll go out in a bit and get some formula and a baby bottle.
She glances at Connor.
Oh, and there's a first aid kit around here somewhere for the bite on your arm. Whatever that's all about.
Connor suppresses a grin. Sonia doesn't miss a thing.
How much longer?
Asks the oldest of the three cellar rats. A muscular guy who looks at Connor with intense distrust, as if Connor might challenge his role as alpha male or something.
What do you care? Says Sonia. You got a pressing appointment?
The kid doesn't respond. He just glares at Sonia and crosses his arms, displaying a shark tattooed on his forearm.
Ooh, thinks Connor with a smirk. Intimidating. Now I'm really scared.
Sonia sighs.
4 more days until I'm rid of you for good.
What happens in 4 days?
Risa asks.
The ice cream man comes.
And with that, Sonia climbs up the stairs faster than Connor thought she'd be able to. The trap door bangs closed.
Dear sweet dragon lady won't tell us what happens next, says the second boy, a lanky blonde kid with a faint smirk that seems permanently fixed on his face.
He has braces on teeth that don't appear to need them. Although his eyes tell of sleepless nights, his hair is perfect. Connor can tell that this kid, despite the rags he's wearing, comes from money.
We get sent to harvest camp, and they cut us apart. That's what happens next, says the girl.
She's Asian and looks almost as tough as the kid with the tattoo, with hair dyed a deep shade of pink and a spiked leather choker on her neck. Shark Boy looks at her sharply.
Will you shut up with your end-of-the-world crap?
Connor notices that the kid has 4 parallel scratch marks on one side of his face, consistent with fingernails. The girl has a black eye.
It's not the end of the world, she grumbles.
just the end of us.
You're beautiful when you're nihilistic, says the smirker.
Shut up.
You're only saying that because you don't know what nihilistic means.
Risa gives Connor a look, and he knows what she's thinking.
We have to suffer through 4 days with this crew?
Still, she's the first to hold out her hand to them and introduce herself. Reluctantly, Connor does the same. Turns out each of these kids, just like every Unwind, has a story that ranks a 10 on the Kleenex scale. The smirker is Hayden. As Connor predicted, he comes from a ridiculously wealthy family. When his parents got a divorce, there was a brutal custody battle over him. 2 years and 6 court dates later, it still wasn't resolved. In the end, the only thing his mother and father could agree on was that each would rather see Hayden unwound than allow the other parent to have custody.
If you could harness the energy of my parents' spite, Hayden tells him, you could power a small city for several years.
The girl is Mai. Her parents kept trying for a boy until they finally got one, but not before having 4 girls first. Mai was the 4th.
It's nothing new, Mai tells them. Back in China, in the days when they only allowed 1 kid per family, people were killing off their baby girls left and right.
The big kid is Roland. He had dreams of being a military buff, but apparently had too much testosterone, or steroids, or a combination of both, leaving him a little too scary even for the military. Like Connor, Roland got into fights at school, although Connor suspected Roland's fights were much, much worse. That's not what did him in, though. Roland had beaten up his stepfather for beating his mom. The mother took her husband's side, and the stepfather got off with a warning. Roland, on the other hand, was sent to be unwound.
That's so unfair, Risa tells him.
It's like what happened to you is any fairer, says Connor.
Roland fixes his gaze on Connor. It's emotional stone.
You keep talking to her in that tone of voice, maybe she'll find herself a new boyfriend.
Connor smiles with mocking warmth at him, and glances at the tattoo on his wrist.
I like your dolphin.
Roland is not amused. It's a tiger shark, idiot.
Connor makes a mental note never to turn his back on Roland. Sharks, Connor once read, have a deadly form of claustrophobia. It's not so much a fear of enclosed spaces as it is an inability to exist in them. No one knows why. Some say it's the metal in aquariums that throws their equilibrium off, but whatever it is, big sharks don't last long in captivity. After a day in Sonia's basement, Connor knows how they feel. Risa has the baby to keep her occupied. It requires a huge amount of attention, and although she gripes about the responsibility, Connor can tell she's thankful simply to have something to help pass the hours. There's a back room to the basement, and Roland insists that Risa have it for herself and the baby. He acts like he's doing it to be kind, but it's obvious that he's doing it because he can't stand the baby's crying. Mai reads. There's a whole collection of dusty old books in the corner, and Mai always has one in her hand. Roland, having surrendered the back room to Risa, pulls out a shelving unit and sets up his own private residence behind it. He occupies the space like he's had experience with being in a cell. When he's not sitting in his little cell, he's reorganizing the food in the basement into rations.
I take care of the food, he announces. Now that there's 5 of us, I'll redivide the rations and decide who gets what and when.
I can decide what I want and when for myself, Connor tells him.
Not gonna work that way, Roland says. I had things under control before you got here. It's gonna stay that way.
Then he hands Connor a can of Spam. Connor looks at it in disgust.
You want better? Roland says. Then you get with the program.
Connor tries to weigh the wisdom of getting into a fight over this, but wisdom rarely arrives when Connor is ticked off. It's Hayden who diffuses the situation before it can escalate. Hayden grabs the can from Connor and pulls open the top.
You snooze, you lose, he says,
and begins eating the Spam casually with his fingers.
Never had Spam till I came here. Now I love it.
Then he grins.
God help me. I'm turning into trailer trash.
Roland glares at Connor, and Connor glares back.
Then he says what he always says at moments like this. Nice socks. Although Roland doesn't look down right away, it derails him just enough for him to back off. He doesn't check to see if his socks match until he thinks Connor isn't looking, and the moment he does, Connor snickers. Small victories are better than none. Hayden is a bit of a riddle. Connor's not sure whether he's actually amused by everything that goes on around him, or if it's all just an act. A way of defending himself against a situation too painful to allow himself to feel. Usually Connor disliked rich, affected kids like Hayden. But there's something about Hayden that simply makes it impossible not to like him. Connor sits next to Hayden, who glances to make sure that Roland has gone behind his shelving unit.
"I like the nice socks maneuver," says Hayden. "Mind if I use that sometime?"
"Be my guest." Hayden pulls off a piece of Spam and offers it to Connor. Although it's the last thing Connor wants right now, he takes it because he knows it's not about the meat, just as he knows Hayden didn't take it because he wanted it. The chunk of processed ham passes from Hayden to Connor, and something between them relaxes. An understanding is reached. "I'm on your side," that piece of Spam says. "I've got your back."
"Did you mean to have the baby?" Hayden asks.
Connor considers how he might answer. He figures the truth is the best way to begin even a tentative friendship.
"It's not mine."
Hayden nods.
"It's cool that you're hanging out with her even though the kid's not yours."
"It's not hers either." Hayden smirks. He doesn't ask how the baby came into their possession, because apparently the version he's come up with in his mind is far more entertaining than anything Connor can offer.
"Well, don't tell Roland," he says. "The only reason he's being so nice to the two of you is because he believes in the sanctity of the nuclear family."
Connor can't tell whether Hayden's being serious or sarcastic. He suspects he'll never figure that out. Hayden chows down the last of the Spam, looks into the empty can, and sighs.
"My life is a Morlock," he says.
"Am I supposed to know what that is?"
"Light-sensitive underground frogmen, often portrayed in bad green rubber costumes. Sadly, this is what we've become, except for the green rubber costume part."
Connor glances at the food shelves. When he listens closely, he can hear the tinny beat of music coming from the antique MP3 player Roland must have stolen from upstairs when he first arrived.
"How long have you known Roland?"
3 days longer than you," Hayden says. "Word to the unwise, which I suspect you are, Roland is fine as long as he thinks he's in charge. As long as you let him think that, we're all one big happy family."
"What if I don't want him to think that?"
Hayden tosses his can of Spam into the trash a few feet away.
"The thing about Morlocks is that they're known to be cannibals."
Connor can't sleep that first night. Between the discomfort of the basement and his distrust of Roland, all he can do is doze for moments at a time. He won't sleep in the side room with Risa because the space is small and he and Risa would have to sleep right up against each other. He tells himself the real reason is that he's afraid of rolling over on the baby during the night. Mai and Hayden are also awake. It looks like Mai's trying to sleep, but her eyes are open and her mind is somewhere else. Hayden has lit a candle he found in the debris, making the basement smell like cinnamon over mildew. Hayden passes his hand back and forth over the flame. He doesn't move slowly enough to burn himself, but he does move slowly enough to feel the heat. Hayden notices Connor watching him.
"It's funny how a flame can only burn your hand if you move too slow," Hayden says. "You can tease it all you want, and it never gets you, if you're quick enough."
"Are you a pyro?" Connor asks.
"You're confusing boredom with obsession."
Connor can sense, however, that there's more to it.
"I've been thinking about kids that get unwound," says Hayden.
"Why would you want to do that?" asks Connor.
"Because," says Mai from across the room, "he's a freak."
"I'm not the one wearing a dog collar." Mai flips Hayden the finger, which he ignores.
"I've been thinking about how harvest camps are like black holes. Nobody knows what goes on inside."
"Everybody knows what goes on," says Connor.
"No," says Hayden. "Everybody knows the result, but nobody knows how unwinding works. I want to know how it happens. Does it happen right away, or do they keep you waiting?
Do they treat you kindly or coldly?
Well, Mai sneers, maybe if you're lucky, you'll get to find out firsthand.
You know what? Says Connor. You think too much. Well, somebody has to make up for the collective lack of brain power down here.
Now Connor finally begins to get it. Even though Hayden has put the candle down, all this talk of unwinding is just like passing his hand across the flame. He likes to linger at the edge of dangerous places, dangerous thoughts. Connor thinks about his own favorite edge, behind the freeway road sign. In a way, they're both alike.
Fine, Connor tells him. Think about stuff until your head explodes. But the only thing I want to think about is surviving to 18.
I find your shallowness both refreshing and disappointing at the same time. Do you think that means I need therapy?
No. I think your parents deciding to unwind you just to spite each other means you need therapy.
Good point. You have a lot of insight for a Morlock.
Then Hayden gets quiet for a moment. The smirk on his face fades.
If I actually get unwound, I think it will bring my parents back together.
Connor doesn't have the heart to burst his fantasy, but Mai does.
Nah. If you get unwound, they'll just blame each other for it and hate each other even more.
Maybe, says Hayden. Or maybe they'll finally see the light, and it'll be Humphrey Dunphy all over again.
Who?
Says Mai. They both turn toward her. Hayden cracks a wide smile.
You mean you've never heard of Humphrey Dunphy?
Mai looks around suspiciously.
Should I have?
The smile never leaves Hayden's face.
Mai, I'm truly amazed that you don't know this. It's your kind of story.
He reaches for the candle and pushes it out so that it sits between the three of them.
It's not a campfire, he says, but it'll have to do.
Hayden looks into the flame for a moment, then slowly, eerily turns his eyes toward Mai.
Years ago, there was this kid. His name wasn't really Humphrey. It was probably Hal or Harry or something like that, but Humphrey kind of fits, considering. Anyway, one day his parents signed the order to have him unwound.
Why? Asks Mai.
Why do any parents sign the order? They just did. And the juvie cops came for him bright and early one morning. They snatch him, ship him off, and it's over for him. He's unwound without a hitch.
So that's it?
Asks Mai. No, because there is a hitch, says Connor, picking up where Hayden left off. See, the Dunphys? They're not what you would call stable people. They were a little bit nuts to begin with, but after their kid is unwound, they lose it completely. Now Mai's tough girl exterior is all but gone. She truly is like a little kid listening wide-eyed to a campfire story.
What did they do?
They decided they didn't want Humphrey unwound after all, says Hayden.
Wait a second, says Mai. You said they already unwound him.
Hayden's eyes look maniacal in the candlelight.
They did.
Mai shudders.
Here's the thing, says Hayden. Like I said, everything about Harvest Camp is a secret, even the records of who receives what once the unwinding is done.
Yeah, so?
So the Dunphys found the records. The father, I think, worked for the government, so he was able to hack into the parts department.
The what?
Hayden sighs.
The National Unwind Database?
Oh.
And he gets a printout of every single person who's received a piece of Humphrey. Then the Dunphys go traveling around the world to find them, so they can kill them, take back the parts, and bit by bit make Humphrey whole.
No way.
That's why people call him Humphrey, Connor adds. 'Cause all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humphrey together again. The thought hangs heavy in the air until Hayden, leaning forward over the candle, suddenly throws his hands out toward Mai and shouts,
Boo!
They all flinch in spite of themselves, Mai most of all. Connor has to laugh.
Did you see that? She practically jumped out of her skin.
Better not do that, Mai, says Hayden. Jump out of your skin and they'll give it to somebody else before you can get it back.
You can both just take a flying leap.
Mai tries to punch Hayden, but he easily evades her.
That's when Roland appears from behind his bookshelves.
What's going on here?
Nothing, says Hayden. Just telling ghost stories. Roland looks at the three of them, clearly irritated, and distrustful of any situation not involving him.
Yeah, well, get to bed. It's late.
Roland lumbers back to his corner, but Connor's sure he's monitoring the conversation now, probably paranoid that they're plotting against him.
That Humphrey Dumphrey thing? Says Mai. It's just a story, right?
Connor keeps his opinion to himself, but Hayden says, I knew a kid who used to tell people he had Humphrey's liver. Then one day, he disappeared and was never seen again. People said he just got unwound, but then again, maybe the Dunphys got him. Then Hayden blows out the candle, leaving them in darkness. On Connor and Reese's third day there, Sonya calls each of them upstairs, but one at a time, in the order they'd arrived.
First the thieving ox, she says, pointing down the stairs at Roland.
Apparently she knows about the stolen MP3 player.
What do you suppose the dragon lady wants?
Hayden asks after the trap door is closed.
To drink your blood, says Mai. Beat you with her cane for a while, stuff like that.
I wish you'd stop calling her the dragon lady, Risa says. She's saving your ass. The least you could do is show some respect. She turns toward Connor.
You want to take Dee Dee? My arms are getting tired.
Connor takes the baby, cradling it a bit more skillfully than he had before. Mai looks at him with mild interest. He wonders if Hayden told her they're not really the baby's parents. Roland comes back from his appointment with Sonya half an hour later and says nothing about it. Neither does Mai when she comes back. Hayden takes the longest, and when he returns, he's closed-mouthed too, which is strange for him. It's unsettling. Connor goes next. It's night outside when he goes upstairs. He has no idea what time of night. Sonya sits with him in her little back room, putting him in an uncomfortable chair that wobbles whenever he moves.
He'll be leaving here tomorrow,
she tells him.
Going where?
She ignores the question and reaches into the drawer of an old roll-top desk.
I'm hoping you're at least semi-literate.
Why? What do you want me to read?
You don't have to read anything.
Then she pulls out several sheets of blank paper.
I want you to write.
What, my last will and testament? Is that it?
A will implies you have something to pass on, which you don't. What I want you to do is write a letter.
She hands him the paper, a pen, and an envelope.